This is I Choose Life News and Views, sponsored by Indiana Right to Life and Allen County Right to Life, committed to defending innocent human life for all people of all ages. Your hosts are Kathy Humbarger, Abigail Lorenzen, and Scott Kump.
Welcome to I Choose Life News and Views. I'm Kathy Humbarger.
I'm Abigail Lorenzen.
And I'm Scott Kump. I Choose Life News and Views is a joint project of Allen County Right to Life, Indiana Right to Life, and Bot Radio Network in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
This program is sponsored in part by Rock Hill Design, serving nonprofits and entrepreneurs with personal branding, print design, and web creation. Learn more at rockhilldesign.com.
With us today in studio is our good friend Mike Spencer. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Abby. How are you?
Doing well. Glad you could join us again.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
For those of you who aren't familiar with Mike, he is a longtime friend of Allen County Right to Life and of Kathy Humbarger in particular, and myself as well. And one of the things that he does in conjunction with us is he helps us coordinate every year our Life Defenders Boot Camp training, which happens during the summers. So at the end here, we'll tell you a little bit about this year's camp. And hopefully, if you know some teenagers or college kids in the area, you can send them our way for that. But today, we're going to look at apologetics in particular. You know, it's sort of a word that maybe we're not familiar with. Of course, Mike and I sort of swim in this pond now. But for those people who maybe don't know what the word apologetics means or what all it entails, or maybe have only heard about it in the context of faith, so faith apologetics or Christian apologetics, we're going to flesh that out a little bit for you and give you some examples of some apologetic responses that maybe you can put into practice in your daily conversations. If you've got friends who are pro-choice or people who just maybe aren't as sure in their pro-life views as what we'd like them to be, here's maybe a couple things that you can roll around in your brain and introduce them to. So, Mike, give us a little overview. What are apologetics? And you call yourself an apologist. Sure. So what does that mean?
Sure. Well, apologetics comes from the Greek word apologia, which we find in 1 Peter 3:15, which is kind of considered the classic verse for apologetics, because there Peter writes to the church and says, always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. Now, that word answer in the Greek word, again, is the word apologia, which we translate into the English word apologetics, which doesn't mean I'm sorry.
Right, yeah. Apologizing.
Yeah. Rather, it means a defense or an argument. And so really, in this sense, in a classical sense, we could say that we're called to be arguers, not to be argumentative. The Bible clearly condemns that. But we're called to be arguers in the sense that we give a defense or an argument for the faith that we have. Now, when Peter wrote that, of course, he wasn't talking about pro-life apologetics. He was talking about the gospel, and he was talking about a defense of that. But we don't do any damage to the context there by broadening the application. And that's why we refer to pro-life apologetics as kind of one division of Christian apologetics. Mm-hmm. An apologist is really anybody that defends their faith, or a pro-life apologist would be anybody that's defending the case for life or defending the unborn. And so we're really, in that sense, all called to be that.
Yeah. I feel like there's a basis for truth there, right?
That's
you
right.
Defend the truth, and that if somebody is coming to you with differing views, that then you have a responsibility to sort of make plain the truth through discussion or argument, as you mentioned earlier. Yeah. So parents, when you ask your kids to apologize, be careful.
That's right.
Because they might give you a defense back.
That's right.
So what is the benefit? What's the goal of pro-life apologetics? Because sometimes we wonder, okay, is it actually helpful to just sit here and argue with someone about this? Am I ever actually going to change their mind?
Right. Well, and on that note, you know, you're right for bringing that up, because there really is sort of a mentality that is prevalent today in the church that says, especially with respect to the subject of abortion, that says, well, look, we've been arguing about this for 40 plus years. Nobody ever changes their mind. Why don't we just all leave it alone?
Right.
That's actually not true. People do change their minds. In fact, I'm one that did. I came to faith in Christ when I was 21 years old. Up until that point, I considered myself pro-choice. I knew abortion was wrong. I knew it was a sin. But I saw it as kind of a necessary evil. And I won't go into all of the story of my transformation on that. But the bottom line is I saw for the first time with my own eyes what abortion did to little boys and girls, and I couldn't believe it. That had a profound impact on me. But the point being is that people do change their mind. And in fact, I'm in schools and universities throughout the United States and frequently hearing people, students and faculty members, professors, coming up to me and saying that they had changed their mind as a result of something that I taught, or maybe had changed their mind even prior to my showing up that day. But the point is people do change their mind. So the benefit or the goal of pro-life apologetics, really in one word, is persuasion. We are trying to persuade. We give good reasons to believe what it is that we believe, because as Paul writes in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, when he talks about the ministry of reconciliation, he said, we try to persuade men or people in general. So apologetics is not a means to show how smart you are. It's not an end in and of itself. Apologetics, rather, is the means to an end. And the end, again, is persuasion. And so we do want to win the argument. 2 Corinthians 10:5 says that we demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God. So we want to demolish the so-called pro-choice argument, but we don't want to demolish the person that's putting forth that argument.
Yes.
And Antonin Scalia, the former and now late Supreme Court justice, said it this way. He said, I attack ideas. I don't attack people. And some very good people have some very bad ideas. And if you can't separate the two, you got to get another day job. And I think that's well said.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, referring back again to the 1 Peter passage, the 1 Peter 3:15, after Peter tells the church to always be prepared to give an answer, he then goes on to say, but do this with gentleness and respect.
Yes.
So the goal here is not monologue, it's dialogue, it's persuasion. We are ambassadors, according to 2 Corinthians chapter 5. And in fact, Paul writes there that we try to persuade men as if God were making his appeal through us, which I've always found to be rather interesting language, because that's indeed what God is doing, is he is making his appeal through us. So we're not called to be apologetic junkies. In other words, just to be people who kind of collect information and knowledge and have right answers for things.
Right.
But we are called to be ambassadors, evangelists. Christ's love is what compels us. Ravi Zacharias, a name that I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with, the Christian apologist and philosopher, said, never answer a question, always answer a questioner. In other words, we don't want to simply give a good answer to a challenge or an objection somebody might raise, but we want to speak to the heart, to the hurts, to the pains, to the doubts, you know, that people have.
Right.
And so that's really important. So there are some very capable apologists who, frankly, are not very effective evangelists or ambassadors, because they've got the knowledge, but they really don't have the wisdom or the artful manner or method in which to deliver that message.
Yeah. One of the terms that we use a lot, especially in conjunction with life defenders, is winsome.
That's right.
We want winsome
arguments,
because there's no, you're not doing any good if you're going out there and you're bullying people with this knowledge that you've got in your brain.
You know, and people do want to talk about abortion, you know, and it's another misnomer that, well, people are tired of talking about it. No, that's not true. People want to talk about abortion, but they don't want to talk about it with bullies.
Yeah.
And they don't want to talk about it with people that are arrogant or ignorant. They want to talk about it with people who are intelligent and with people who, as you said, are winsome.
Yep. That's one thing. I'm glad you brought that up, because obviously in our lines of work now, we deal with this topic every day. And you know that when you're hanging out with your friends in the evening or whatever, work tends to be a topic of conversation. So in my life, abortion tends to be a topic of conversation that comes up with people. And I always try to kind of watch myself, like, am I bringing this up or are they bringing this up? Because I don't want to, it's not really dinner conversation per se, but more times than not, it's the people that I'm talking to that bring up the topic of abortion, because they know that this is what I deal with all the time.
Sure.
People do want to talk about it, especially if they feel themselves that they're not informed about the topic. They want to discuss it and see what you have to say about it.
Yeah. Well, you know, people are very animated on this subject, regardless of what side of the issue they find themselves on. And so generating conversation over the subject is usually not too difficult.
Yeah. And if they're not animated about it, it's probably because they haven't done a whole lot of thinking
on
the
topic.
That's right.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. If they're apathetic, it's probably they haven't really dug into it, because it's a sort of a polarizing, not sort of, it is.
It is.
It's a polarizing issue. But you can still be winsome. You can still be gentle.
That's right. And, you know, just, I know this is not the subject of the discussion today. However, the reality is that when we can speak intelligently and graciously to the most defining moral issue of our time, abortion, it really opens the door to talk about the gospel.
Yeah.
And to talk about truth, moral objective truth and things like this. And so it's really a gateway to talk about even the greater issue and or the greater need. And that is, you know, the need for Jesus Christ.
Yep. Another thing that you said earlier triggered this thought in my head. You know, do people, what's the point of apologetics? Why are we talking about this? Are people convinced? if we don't talk about the pro-life issue, if we don't do the apologetics piece, if we're not informing people, we're not giving them the opportunity to be convinced.
Yeah, that's right.
You can't persuade someone if you're not saying anything.
Exactly.
You know, and we are called to evangelize, to spread the truth, and to abolish lies. And so if that truth isn't coming out of your mouth, you are not giving people the opportunity to learn the truth, to see the truth,
yes,
and to rewire their thinking.
Yep, absolutely.
So let's do a little bit of this and talk about some specific challenges, maybe some specific sayings that we come up against that we see a lot. And the first one, as long as we're talking about the Christian faith and how that relates in, one that we hear is the Bible's silent on abortion, therefore it's okay.
Well, this is a popular one, and sadly, we hear this in the church. This is where we typically hear this. And of course, not just those in the church. In the last year or so, I know Whoopi Goldberg on The View has has put this argument, if you can call it an argument, has put this forth, at least on a couple of occasions. She said that there's nothing in the book referring to the Bible that says anything about abortion. She says, let's make sure of that. The Ten Commandments are the Ten Commandments, and there's only 10.
Mm.
Now, the faulty assumption that Whoopi and others who would put this out there, the faulty assumption that they're operating under is that what the Bible does not expressly condemn, it therefore condones.
Yes.
Now, that at first blush may sound compelling, but when you really peel the onion back just a layer or two, you see how quickly this falls apart. For instance, there are a lot of things that the Bible does not expressly condemn that we know are wrong implicitly. For instance, the Bible nowhere condemns the torturing of puppies or pouring toxins into our rivers.
Right.
And yet we know implicitly that those things are wrong because God's word does call us to steward that which he has created. Mm-hmm. And so we know implicitly that those things are wrong. The Bible is not silent on abortion any more than the Bible is silent on suffocating someone with a pillow. And that's actually a line from Francis Beckwith. And I think that's really an excellent point. Abortion is simply a method of killing innocent human beings. And we do not need a Bible verse to expressly condemn every specific method of killing innocent human beings. In fact, if the Bible did articulate or state every method of murder, let's say, that was wrong, well, all methods of murder are wrong, but every method of killing innocent human beings that is wrong, our Bibles would look like the IRS tax code. They would be so thick, unfortunately, that we would not be able to carry them to church on a Sunday morning, because sadly, since the beginning of time, since Cain killed Abel, mankind has been pretty creative in the ways and the methods that they've devised to kill each other over these years. So we don't need a Bible verse expressly condemning every specific method of killing that is wrong, nor do we need a Bible verse expressly condemning the killing of certain classes of human beings, for instance, the unborn, any more than we would need one expressly condemning the murder of Hispanics or freshmen in high school or women or whatever. And so this, again, it's a very weak argument to say the very least, but it is one that we need to know how to respond to because it has got such a hold in the body of Christ.
Next one, we'll fire another one at you. And we've had this actually tweeted at us, which is exciting. It says, you're not really pro-life unless, and then there's any number of phrases that you could fill in. You're not really pro-life unless you're anti-war, you're anti-death penalty, you're anti-gun rights, or if you champion universal health care, if you are ready to adopt every child who's at risk for abortion.
Right.
That's one we've heard too a lot is if you're not adopting kids yourself, you're not pro-life. Or supporting open borders is one that's come up with the election.
Yeah, that's
you can't
big, no.
be pro-life
sure.
and support closed borders.
Well, look, even if this is true, even if we were to sort of grant this, that you're not really pro-life unless, because really this is a kind of a backdoor ad hominem is what's going on here. This is really a subtle way of suggesting that pro-lifers are hypocrites or inconsistent. But even if that were true, this does nothing to defeat the argument that abortion unjustly ends the life of innocent human beings. That's the argument that we're putting out there. So this is really nothing less than a disingenuous effort to distract us or to silence our voice for the voiceless. No other social cause is held to the same standard. So imagine saying to the American Cancer Society, well, you have no right to focus on curing cancer unless you also work to fight AIDS or to cure heart disease or diabetes.
Or every other disease that kills someone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now, this would be ludicrous. This would be so insulting. I'm a cancer survivor, and I'm going to tell you what, I'm glad that the American Cancer Society is narrowly focused like a laser beam on fighting cancer. I don't want them fighting every other disease or every other social ill under the sun, because the minute they divest like that, their attention and their resources, they're not going to be effective at the thing that they're there to do, and that is to fight cancer. So this is really, I guess I want to say a really disingenuous or sneaky tactic to use, although I'm not sure that everybody that's doing it realizes what they're doing, that they're doing it with some malice necessarily. But pro-lifers, in the end, focus narrowly on rescuing the preborn, because the abortion industry and their allies focus narrowly on killing them.
This
is the defining moral issue of our day, and it deserves a laser beam focus from the church. We don't believe it's the only issue, but we do believe it is the defining moral issue of our day.
We see this same thing, too, in people saying, well, you're just pro-birth, you're not pro-life.
Right.
And I'd go through the same thing with people there, too. I had a high schooler sort of pose this as a question during one of our presentations that I was doing. And he sort of seemed to have a little edge on the question, a little accusatory. But, you know, it's interesting to explore with them. We have pregnancy resource centers that focus on children and parents after the child's born. We have resources.
That's right.
211 and United Way and all of these other resources available for people to focus on the family after the child's born. We focus on before the child's born.
Right.
And if we were to broaden our sort of range of what we do, we would no longer be able to invest our resources so specifically and so focusedly.
Well,
so you're laser being focused that idea on this particular issue and actually get something done.
Well, and I think with many of the people who are putting forth this argument are actually doing it deliberately to weaken us, to dilute our message and our efforts so that we're not effective at anything. And I think it was Frederick the Great that is credited for saying, he who fights everywhere fights nowhere.
Right.
So we don't make apologies for the fact that we're laser beam focused. That said, there is an argument or a defense to be made for the fact that, as you alluded to, that Christians, pro-lifers, are engaged not only in helping babies on that side of the birth canal, but on this side of the birth canal. In other words, we do care about babies once they're born. There are right now almost 3,000 pregnancy care centers, 2,100 actually, but many of those centers have two, three, four locations.
Yeah.
So a total of about 2,900 plus pregnancy care centers throughout the United States that are there to help mothers and their babies, regardless of whether or not those babies have been born. And I get to see a lot of these pregnancy care centers across the United States, and they've got baby boutiques where, you know, diapers and clothing and all kinds of things.
Learn to earn programs.
Yes, counseling, free ultrasounds in many of these centers. Many of these centers are providing free medical care, doctors that they're working with, or even free attorney fees. So this idea that we're not really pro-life, we're only pro-birth, it sounds really good, but it's just not true.
Right. A nice way to prove that one wrong is to simply ask them about a pro-lifer in their life that they know.
Yeah, that's right. But again, we want to be careful here, because what we don't want to let the other side do is to pull us away from the main issue. The main issue here is not the character of pro-lifers, because even if we are all a bunch of hypocrites who really don't care about babies once they're born, again, that still does nothing to defeat the argument that abortion unjustly ends the life of an innocent human being. And that's wrong.
Good point. The next objection that gets thrown at us is referred to as the religious objection. So the pro-life view that humans have an intrinsic value is religious and therefore can't be proved empirically or argued for rationally. Some people will say, oh, it's a philosophic view as to when a human being actually starts living. So you must take this person on faith. Therefore, religiously informed beliefs about the unborn have no place in the public square and can't be used to restrict abortion.
Well, look, even non-believers, even atheists can recognize that human beings have value in virtue of the kind of thing that they are. Just because the pro-life view is consistent with or even informed by a particular religious viewpoint does not mean that it cannot be defended without arguments that are exclusive to that view. Now, admittedly, the atheist is going to have a real hard time grounding human value in anything objective.
Right.
But nonetheless, on the surface, even the atheist would agree with us generally that it is wrong to intentionally take the life of innocent human beings. So opposing abortion because one believes that the unborn are intrinsically valuable human beings is no more religious than believing it's morally wrong to unjustly end the lives of Hispanics or women just because one is convinced that these classes of human beings are intrinsically valuable. And who says that religious truth claims don't count as real knowledge? That's a silly argument. The Declaration of Independence, Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail, President Lincoln's second inaugural address all have their roots in the doctrine of the Imago Dei. that we are God's image bearers and therefore of intrinsic value and worth. Are we going to dismiss all of those documents that have clear religious, even Christian, distinctively Christian underpinnings as irrational? So many of these challenges, so many of these objections or so-called arguments that we see from the other side, when you really take a look at them, you just see how really hollow they ring.
Yeah. If you're joining us just now, I'm with Mike Spencer of Life Training Institute, and he's doing some apologetics work with us. So answering some of these challenges that we receive from the pro-choice side, hoping to equip you guys and to just sort of further your knowledge of the pro-life movement. So the next argument we're going to deal with is the brain dead argument. If brain death is the end of a person, can we not agree brain function is the beginning of a person?
Okay, this is, again, a very popular objection. We hear it all the time on high school and university campuses. Well, let me respond to this in a couple of ways. First of all, a brain dead person is in fact dead, meaning that he or she has suffered an irreversible loss of all coordinated bodily function, including brain function.
Right.
A columnist and senior editor of National Review, Ramesh Panuru, said, quote, he said, "We don't treat brain dead people as dead because they are living human organisms who happen no longer to be persons. Rather, we treat them as dead because they are no longer organisms, no longer capable of directing their own growth and development."
Right.
So the embryo or the embryo's brain is in the not yet category, meaning that it has yet to develop. Mm-hmm. Whereas the brain dead person is in the category of no more. That is a significant difference. The embryo is nothing like the brain dead person because the embryo does not need a brain to live. For the embryo, something else coordinates the bodily systems so that it functions as a coordinated whole. We get what we need when we need it. So for instance, a 4-year-old girl does not have a fully functioning reproductive system because she doesn't need it yet.
Right.
So if we had reason to believe that the brain dead person would or even might awaken several months later, then we couldn't justify taking his or her organs. And that is the same exact condition of the embryo. It is a living organism developing fully human, though not fully mature.
Right.
So I would just say, you know, that there's a significant difference between the category of not yet and no more.
Yeah. Okay, so here's one. We all hear about, quote, the hard cases, and this is one, and it's also referred to as the exceptions. And in my own dialoguing with people, this is one where people really have to start thinking and looking inside of themselves and really pulling out, what do I think about this, and how does what I think line up with reality and consistency? And that's the rape challenge. So the challenge says something like this. Okay, maybe abortion is wrong, but would you really want to force a woman or a young girl who's been raped, a horrible, horrible experience, horribly violent, and then has become pregnant to carry a child to term?
Well, when I speak, particularly on high school campuses, but this would be true in universities as well, but when I speak on high school campuses, a lot of times I'll do an assembly in the morning, and at the end of the assembly, students will have the opportunity to come forward to microphones and ask questions. And I can tell you that almost every time, this will be the first question asked. And it is the question that I think pro-lifers kind of tremble at, because many pro-lifers who genuinely value the unborn will nonetheless say, yeah, but you know, what about in the case of rape? So this is a serious objection. It's a big challenge, but there are good answers, or there is a good answer for it. I think there's two ways that we need to respond to this. The first thing we need to do is identify and acknowledge the difficulty of the challenge, just to be honest about this. So now this is how I do this. Of course, you and your audience would do this differently, but this is how I will respond. I will usually say something like this. Well, look, you're raising a really difficult challenge, and I appreciate it. I am married to a woman, and I have 4 daughters and 2 granddaughters, and I cannot imagine one of my loved ones being raped. And then furthermore, then to be facing an unwanted pregnancy, a child that they didn't choose to conceive. I can't imagine the agony of this. And to do what some pro-lifers do, many pro-lifers do, to dismiss this by saying, well, that's less than 1%. That is a horrible answer.
Yeah, not helpful.
It's calloused. Less than 1% is still a lot of women and a lot of young girls who are raped and do conceive children against their own will.
Right.
And so that is not helpful. So the first thing we want to do is we want to identify, acknowledge the difficulty of the challenge, the emotional, psychological difficulty of the challenge. But then we want to ask a focus question. And the question is simply this: but how should a civilized society treat innocent members of society who happen to remind us of a painful event? Should we kill them? You see, the question in the case of rape where a woman or a young girl has conceived a child against her will, the question is not how was one conceived,
right,
but was one conceived?
Exactly.
And so we are really fighting an uphill battle, admittedly, as a pro-life community in America, when we deny even the rape exception. We're made to look as calloused towards women, mm-hmm, insensitive towards rape victims. But I don't think that's really fair at all. I don't think that's accurate. I think we can love both the mother and the baby that she has conceived. Allowing the woman or the young girl who has been violated in this horrible way, has suffered this unspeakable crime, to now go and perpetuate another act of violence against another human being, another
right,
innocent human being, namely her son or daughter, is not being sensitive. And so we really need to ask the question, not how was one conceived, but was one conceived? The tragic violence of rape does not justify the tragic violence of abortion. You know, there are people in your audience today that were conceived by loving parents in marriage.
Right.
And then there are certainly people in your audience today who were conceived in marriage, but maybe mom and dad fought all the time and, mm-hmm, didn't get along very well at all. And certainly you've got some in your audience who were conceived out of wedlock, and no doubt some in your audience who were conceived through the violent act of rape. But regardless, it doesn't alter or change in any way a person's nature, their ontological nature, or their value as a human being. So I just don't think it's right to give the death penalty to the innocent victim, the child, for the crimes of the guilty father, the rapist.
Right. There's a really strong message of love and hope there.
Absolutely.
To think about, like, no matter how you were conceived, you have value.
That's right.
And that value is intrinsic, and no one can take that value away from you.
Well,
that's really a very strong message of love there.
It absolutely is. Our position is that every human being matters, black, white, rich, poor, Jew, Gentile, born and unborn, regardless of where they're located. That's the foundation for human equality. And the minute you dissect human equality or you parse it out,
right,
by accepting certain people out of it, you've destroyed the foundation for human equality altogether.
Yeah. So what are some places that people can go if they're interested in some more apologetic information or sort of want to sharpen their skills there? Can you give us some resources, point people in the right direction?
Sure. The ministry that I'm a part of, Life Training Institute, you can go to our website, which is www.prolifetraining.com. That's a great source. We've got a lot of articles there and some videos and things. You can also go to the book, The Case for Life, that, mm-hmm, was authored by the founder and president of Life Training Institute, Scott Klusendorf. This is, without a question, the best popular level book on pro-life apologetics out there. The Case for Life, great book. Another one would be Tactics by Greg Kokel from Stand to Reason Ministry. That's
right,
a great work. It's more of a, not so much a book of what to say, but more of a book on how to say it.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very helpful. And then one more would be Francis Beckwith and Greg Kokel wrote the book Relativism, and it's subtitled Feet Planted Firmly in Midair. Three great books. If your audience grabs those three and reads those and really masters those, they're going to be in a great spot to really defend the unborn in a way that will be confident, compelling, and yeah.
Great. We'll link to all of those on our website, ichooselife.org, underneath the radio tab. For those of you in the area and who know high school and college students in the area, we'll have our Life Defenders Boot Camp. So it's pro-life apologetics this summer, July 7th and 8th. ichooselife.org is the place to look that stuff up. Thanks so much, Mike.
Thank you, Abby.
You've been listening to I Choose Life News and Views. If you have questions about this program or if you'd like to support the fight for life, please call 260-471-1849 or go to ichooselife.org, because without the right to life, no other rights matter.